Peleg looked at the dead man, whose breeches were still untied. He stooped to him and made the sign of the cross on his forehead. The man's death had been quick, and the capture of his companion had been quiet, and none of the woodcutters seemed to have taken alarm. Their axes went on thumping, the echoes rattling in the trees. "We're taking this one back to Alfred," I told Peleg. Then I moved serpent breath to my captive's throat. "Make one sound," I said, pressing the blade into his skin, "and I'll gut you from your overused gullet to your overused crotch. Do you understand?" He nodded. "Because I'm doing you the favour I owe you," I explained, and smiled nicely. "Because my captive was Ethelwald, Alfred's nephew and the would-be king of the West Saxons." The man I killed was named Osberg, and he had been the commander of Wulfhere's household troops. His job on the day of his death was to make certain Ethelwald got into no trouble. Ethelwald had a talent for misfortune. By rights, he should have been the king of Wessex, though I dare say he would have been the last king, for he was impetuous and foolish, and the twin solaces for having lost the throne to his uncle Alfred were ale and women. Yet he had ever wanted to be a warrior. Alfred had denied him the chance, for he had dared not let Ethelwald make a name for himself on the battlefield. Ethelwald, the true king, had to be kept foolish, so that no man saw in him a rival for Alfred's throne. It would have been far easier to have killed Ethelwald, but Alfred was sentimental about family. Or perhaps it was his Christian conscience. But for whatever reason, Ethelwald had been allowed to live, and had rewarded his uncle's mercy by constantly making a fool of himself. But in these last months, he had been released from Alfred's leash, and his thwarted ambition had been given encouragement. He dressed in mail and carried swords. He was a startling-looking man, handsome and tall, and he looked the part of the warrior, though he had no warrior's soul. He'd pissed himself when I put serpent breath to his throat, and now that he was my captive, he showed no defiance. He was submissive, frightened, and glad to be led. He told us how he had pestered Wulfhere to be allowed to fight, and when Osberg had brought a score of men to guide the Danes in the hills, he had been given notional charge of them. "Wulfhere said I was in command," Ethelwald said sullenly. "But I still had to obey Osberg."
"Wulfhere was a damn fool to let you go so far from him," I said.
"I think he was tired of me,"
Ethelwald admitted.
"Tired of you? You were humping his women?"
"She's only a servant. But I wanted to join the scouting parties, and Wulfhere said I could learn a lot from Osberg."
"Well, you've just learned never to piss into a hawthorn bush," I said, "and that's worth knowing."
Ethelwald was riding Peleg's horse, and the Welsh priest was leading the beast by its reins. I had tied Ethelwald's hands. There was still a hint of light in the western sky, just enough to make our journey down the smaller river easy. I explained to Peleg who Ethelwald was, and the priest grinned up at him.
"So, you're the Prince of Wessex, eh?"
"I should be king,"
Ethelwald said sullenly.
"No, you shouldn't," I said.
"My father was, and Guthrum promised to crown me."
"And if you believed him," I said, "you're a damn fool. You'd be king as long as he needed you, then he'd be dead."
"Now Alfred will kill me,"
he said miserably.
"He ought to," I said. "But I owe you a favour."
"You think you can persuade him to let me live?"
he asked eagerly.
"You'll do the persuading," I said. "You'll kneel to him, and you're going to say that you've been waiting for a chance to escape the Danes, and at last you succeeded, and you got away, found us, and have come to offer him your sword."
Ethelwald just stared at me.
"I owe you a favour," I explained, "and so I'm giving you life. I'll untie your hands. You go to Alfred, and you say you're joining him because that's what you've wanted to do ever since Christmas. You understand that?"
Ethelwald frowned.
"But he hates me."
"Of course he does," I agreed.
"But if you kneel to him and swear you never broke your allegiance to him, then what can he do?"
He'll embrace you, reward you, and be proud of you.
Truly?
So long as you tell him where the Danes are, Peerling put in.
I can do that,
Aethelwald said.
They're coming south from Sippenham. They marched this morning.
How many?
5,000.
Coming here?
They're going to wherever Alfred is. They reckon they'll have a chance to destroy him. And after that, it's just a summer of women and silver.
He said the last three words plaintively, and I knew he had been relishing the prospect of plundering Wessex.
So how many men does Alfred have?
He asked. 3,000, I said.
Sweet Jesus,
he said fearfully.
You always wanted to be a warrior, I said. And what name can you make for yourself fighting a smaller army?
Jesus Christ.
The last of the light went. There was no moon, but by keeping the river on our left, we knew we could not get lost. And after a while we saw the glow of firelight showing over the loom of the hills, and knew we were seeing Alfred's encampment. I twisted in the saddle then, and thought I saw another such glow far to the north. Guthrum's army.
If you let me go,
Aethelwald asked sulkily,
what's to stop me going back to Guthrum?
Absolutely nothing, I said, except the certainty that I'll hunt you down and kill you. He thought about that for a short while.
You're sure my uncle will welcome me?
Peerling answered for me.
With open arms, he said.
It'll be like the return of the prodigal son. You'll be welcomed by slaughtered calves and psalms of rejoicing. Just tell Alfred what you told us about Guthrum marching towards us.
We reached the Willig, and the going was easy now, for the light of the campfires was much brighter. I cut Aethelwald free at the edge of the encampment, then gave him back his swords. He carried two, as I did, a long one and a short sax. Well, my prince, I said, time to grovel, eh? We found Alfred at the camp centre. There was no pomp here. We did not have the animals to drag wagons loaded with tents or furniture, so Alfred was seated on a spread cloak between two fires. He looked dispirited, and later I learned that he had assembled the army in the twilight and made them a speech. But the speech, even Beocca admitted, had been less than successful.
It was more a sermon than a speech,
Beocca told me glumly. Alfred had invoked God, spoken of St. Augustine's doctrine of a righteous war, and talked about Boethius and King David, and the words had flown over the heads of the tired, hungry troops. Now Alfred sat with the leading men of the army, all of them eating stale hard bread and smoked eel. Father Adalbert, the priest who had accompanied us to Sippenham, was playing a lament on a small harp. A bad choice of music, I thought. Then Alfred saw me and waved Adalbert to silence.
"You have news?"
he asked. For answer I stood aside and bowed to Aethelwald, gesturing him towards the king. "Lord," I said to Alfred, "I bring you your nephew." Alfred stood. He was taken aback, especially as Aethelwald was plainly no prisoner, for he wore his swords. Aethelwald looked good. Indeed, he looked more like a king than Alfred. He was well-made and handsome, while Alfred was much too thin, and his face was so haggard that he looked much older than his 29 years. And of the two, it was Aethelwald who knew how to behave at that moment. He unbuckled his swords and threw them with a great clatter at his uncle's feet. Then he went to his knees and clasped his hands and looked up into the king's face.
"I have found you,"
he said, with what sounded like utter joy and conviction. Alfred, bemused, did not know what to say, so I stepped forward. "We discovered him, Lord," I said, "in the hills. He was searching for you."
"I escaped Guthrum,"
Aethelwald said.
"God be praised, I escaped the pagan."
He pushed his swords to Alfred's feet.
"My blades are yours, Lord King."
This extravagant display of loyalty
gave Alfred no choice except to raise his nephew and embrace him. The men around the fires applauded. Then Æthelwold gave his news, which was useful enough. Guthrum was on the march, and Svein of the White Horse came with him. They knew where Alfred was, and so they came, 5,000 strong, to give him battle in the hills of Wiltonshire. "When will they get here?" Alfred wanted to know.
"They should reach these hills tomorrow, Lord,"
Æthelwold said. So, Æthelwold was seated beside the king and given water to drink, which was hardly a fit welcome for a prodigal prince, and caused him to throw me a wry glance. And it was then that I saw Harald, Shire Reeve of Devonshire, among the king's companions. "You're here?" I asked, surprised. "With 500 men," he said proudly. We had expected no men from either Devonshire or Thornseater, but Harald, the Shire Reeve, had brought 400 of his own feared, and 100 more from Thornseater. "There's enough men left to protect the coast against the pagan fleet," he said, "and Odder insisted we help defeat Guthrum."
"How is Mildred?"
"She prays for her son," Harald said, "and for all of us."
There were prayers after the meal. There were always prayers when Alfred was around, and I tried to escape them, but Peerlig made me stay.
"The king wants to talk with you," he said.
So I waited while Bishop Æthelwold droned, and afterwards Alfred wanted to know whether Æthelwold had truly run away from the Danes.
"Well, that's what he told me, Lord," I said, "and I can only say we found him."
"He didn't run from us," Peerlig offered, "and he could have done."
"So there's good in the boy," Alfred said.
"God be praised for that," Peerlig said.
Alfred paused, gazing down into the glowing embers of a campfire.
"I spoke to the army tonight," he told us.
"I heard you did, Lord," I said. He looked up at me sharply.
"What did you hear?"
"That you preached to them, Lord." He flinched at that, then seemed to accept the criticism.
"What do they want to hear?" he asked.
"They want to hear," Peerlig answered, "that you are ready to die for them."
"Die?"
"Men follow. Kings lead," Peerlig said.
Alfred waited.
"They don't care about St. Augustine," Peerlig went on. "They only care that their women and children are safe, that their lands are safe, and that they will have a future of their own. They want to know that they'll win. They want to know the Danes are going to die. They want to hear that they'll be rich on plunder."
"Greed, revenge, and selfishness?" Alfred asked.
"If you had an army of angels, Lord," Peerlig went on, "then a rousing speech about God and St. Augustine would doubtless fire their ardour. But you have to fight with mere men. And there's nothing quite like greed, revenge, and selfishness to inspire mortals."
Alfred frowned at that advice, but did not argue with it.
"So I can trust my nephew?"
he asked me. "I don't know that you can trust him," I said, "but nor can Guthrum. And Æthelwold did seek you out, Lord, so be content with that."
"I shall. I shall."
He bade us good night, going to his hard bed. The fires in the valley were dying.
"Why didn't you tell Alfred the truth about Æthelwold?"
I asked Peerlig.
"Well, I thought I would trust your judgment," he said.
"You're a good man,
and that constantly astonishes me."
I went to find Isolt, then slept. Next day, the whole of the northern sky was dark with cloud, while over our army and above the hills was sunlight. The West Saxon army, now almost 3,500 strong, marched up the Willig, then followed the smaller river that Peerlig and I had explored the previous evening. We could see the Danish scouts on the hills, but knew they would be sending messengers back to Guthrum. I led 50 men to one of the hilltops. We were all mounted, all armed, all with shields and helmets, and we rode ready to fight.
but the Danish scouts yielded the ground. There were only a dozen of them, and they rode off the hill long before we reached the summit, where a host of blue butterflies flickered above the springy turf. I gazed northwards at the ominous dark sky, and watched a sparrowhawk stoop. Down the bird went, and I followed its plunging fall, and suddenly saw, beneath the folded wings and reaching claws, our enemy. Guthrum's army was coming south. The fear came then. The shield wall is a terrible place. It is where a warrior makes his reputation, and reputation is dear to us. Reputation is honour, but to gain that honour, a man must stand in the shield wall, where death runs rampant. I'd been in the shield wall at Sinuit, and I knew the smell of death, the stink of it, the uncertainty of survival, the horror of the axes and swords and spears. And I feared it. And it was coming. I could see it coming. For in the lowlands, north of the hills, in the green ground stretching long and level towards distant Sippenham, was an army. The Great Army, the Danes called it. The pagan warriors of Guthrum and Svein, the wild horde of wild men from beyond the sea. They were a dark smear on the landscape. They were coming through the fields, band after band of horsemen, spread across the country. And because their leading men were only just emerging into the sunlight, it seemed as if their hordes sprang from the shadowlands. Spears and helmets and mail and metal reflected the light. A myriad glints of broken sunlight that spread and multiplied as yet more men came from beneath the clouds. They were nearly all mounted. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph," Leofric said. Stiapa said nothing. He just glowered at them. Osric, the Shire Reeve of Wiltonshire, made the sign of the cross.
"Someone has to tell Alfred," he said.
"I'll go," Father Peerling offered.
"Tell him the pagans have crossed the Afan,"
Osric said.
"Tell him they're heading towards..."
He paused, trying to judge where the horde was going.
"Ethandun,"
he finally said. "Ethandun," Peerling repeated the name.
"And remind him... there's a fort of the old people there,"
Osric said. This was his shire, his country, and he knew its hills and fields, and he sounded grim, doubtless wondering what would happen if the Danes found the old fortress and occupied it.
"God help us," Osric said. "They'll be in the hills tomorrow morning, tell him."
"Tomorrow morning at Ethandun," Peerling said, then turned his horse and spurred away. "Where is the fort?" I asked. Osric pointed.
"You can see it."
From this distance, the ancient fastness looked like nothing more than green wrinkles on a far hilltop. All across Wessex there were such forts, with their massive earthen walls, and this one was built at the top of the escarpment that climbed from the lowlands, a place guarding the southern edge of the chalk downs.
"Some of the bastards will get up there tonight,"
Osric said.
"But most won't make it till morning. Let's just hope they ignore the fort."
We'd all thought that Alfred would find a place where Guthrum must attack him, a slope made for defence, a place where our smaller numbers would be helped by the difficult ground. But the sight of that distant fort was a reminder that Guthrum might adopt the same tactics. He might find a place where it would be hard for us to attack him, and Alfred would have a grim choice then. To attack would be to court disaster, while to retreat would guarantee it. Our food would be exhausted in a day or two, and if we tried to withdraw south through the hills, Guthrum would release a horde of horsemen against us. And even if the army of Wessex escaped unscathed, it would be a beaten army. If Alfred brought the fear together, then marched it away from the enemy, men would take it for a defeat, and begin to slip away to protect their homes. We had to fight, because to decline battle was a defeat. The army camped that evening to the north of the woods where I had found Ithelwald. He was in the king's entourage now, and went with Alfred and his war leaders to the hilltop to watch the Danish army as it closed on the hills. Alfred looked a long time.
"How far away are they?"
he asked. "From here," Osric answered. 4 miles. From your army, 6. "Tomorrow, then," Alfred said, making a sign of the cross. The northern clouds were spreading, darkening the evening, but the slanting light reflected from spears and axes at the old people's fort. It seemed Guthrum had not ignored the place after all. We went back down to the encampment to find yet more men arriving. Not many now, just small bands, but still they came. And one such band, travel-weary and dusty, was mounted on horses, and all 16 men had chainmail and good helmets. They were Mercians, and they'd ridden far to the east, crossed the Thames, then looped through Wessex, ever avoiding Danes, and so come to help Alfred. The leader was a short young man, wide in the chest, round-faced and with a pugnacious expression. He knelt to Alfred, then grinned at me, and I recognised my cousin, Ethelred. My mother was a Mercian, though I never knew her, and her brother Ethelred was a power in the southern part of that country, and I'd spent a short time in his hall when I first fled from Northumbria. Back then I'd quarrelled with my cousin, called Ethelred like his father, but he seemed to have forgotten our youthful enmity and embraced me instead. The top of his head just came up to my collarbone.
"We've come to fight,"
he told me, his voice muffled by my chest. "Well, you'll have a fight," I promised him. "Lord," he let go of me and turned back to Alfred. "My father would have sent more men, but he must protect his land."
"He must," Alfred said.
"But he sent the best he has,"
Ethelred went on. He was young and bumptious, a little strut of a youth, but his confidence pleased Alfred, as did the gleaming silver crucifix hanging over Ethelred's chainmail.
"Allow me to present Tatwine," my cousin went on, "the chief of my father's household troops."
I remembered Tatwine, a barrel of a man and a real fighter, whose arms were smothered in blotchy black marks, each made with a needle and ink and representing a man killed in battle. He gave me a crooked smile.
"Still alive, Lord?"
"Still alive, Tatwine.
Be good to fight alongside you again."
"Good to have you here," I said. And it was. Few men are natural-born warriors, and a man like Tatwine was worth a dozen others. Alfred had ordered the army to assemble again. He did it partly so the men could see their own numbers and take heart from that. And he did it, too, because he knew his speech the previous night had left men confused and uninspired. He would try again.
"Oh, I wish he wouldn't," Leofric grumbled. "He can make sermons, but he can't make speeches."
We gathered at the foot of a small hill. The light was fading. Alfred had planted his two banners, the dragon and the cross, on the summit of the hill. But there was a small wind, so the flag stirred rather than flew. He climbed to stand between them. He was alone, dressed in a mail coat, over which he wore the faded blue cloak. A group of priests began to follow him, but he waved them back to the hill's foot. Then he just stared at us, huddled in the meadow beneath him. And for a time he said nothing, and I sensed the discomfort in the ranks. They wanted fire put into their souls, and expected holy water instead.
"Tomorrow,"
he said suddenly. His voice was high, but it carried clearly enough.
"Tomorrow we fight. Tomorrow, the feast of St. John the Apostle."
"Oh, God," Leofric grumbled next to me. "Up to our arseholes in more saints."
"John the Apostle was condemned to death,"
Alfred said.
He was condemned to be boiled in oil. Yet he survived the ordeal. He was plunged into the boiling oil, and he lived. He came from the cauldron a stronger man. And we shall do the same.
He paused, watching us, and no one responded. We all just gazed at him. And he must have known that his homily on St. John was not working, for he made an abrupt gesture with his right hand, as if he were sweeping all the saints aside.
"And tomorrow,"
he went on,
"is also a day for warriors. A day to kill your enemies. A day to make the pagans wish they had never heard of Wessex."
He paused again, and this time there were some murmurs of agreement.
"This is our land. We fight for our homes, for our wives, for our children. We fight for Wessex."
"We do,"
someone shouted.
"And not just Wessex."
Alfred's voice was stronger now.
"We have men from Mercia, men from Northumbria, men from East Anglia."
I knew none from East Anglia, and only Bjorka and I were from Northumbria, but no one seemed to care.
"We are the men of England,"
Alfred shouted.
"And we fight for all Saxons."
Silence again. The men liked what they had heard, but the idea of England was in Alfred's head, not theirs. He had a dream of one country, but it was too big a dream for the army in the meadow.
"And why are the Danes here?"
Alfred asked.
"They want your wives for their pleasure, your children for their slaves, and your homes for their own. But they do not know us."
He said the last six words slowly, spacing them out, shouting each one distinctly.
"They do not know our swords," he went on. "They do not know our axes, our spears, our fierceness. Tomorrow we teach them. Tomorrow we kill them. Tomorrow we hack them into pieces. Tomorrow we make the ground red with their blood and make them whimper. Tomorrow we shall make them call for our mercy."
"None!"
a man called out.
"No mercy!"
Alfred shouted. And I knew he did not mean it. He would have offered every mercy to the Danes. He would have offered them the love of God and tried to reason with them. But in the last few minutes he had at last learned how to talk to warriors.
"Tomorrow!"
he shouted.
"You do not fight for me. I fight for you. I fight for Wessex. I fight for your wives, for your children, and your homes. Tomorrow we fight, and I swear to you on my father's grave and on my children's lives, tomorrow we shall win!"
And that started the cheering. It was not in all honesty a great battle speech, but it was the best Alfred ever gave, and it worked. Men stamped the ground, and those who carried their shields beat them with swords or spears, so that the twilight was filled with a rhythmic thumping as men shouted, "No mercy!" The sound echoed back from the hills. "No mercy! No mercy!" We were ready. And the Danes were ready. That night it clouded over. The stars vanished one by one, and the thin moon was swallowed in the darkness. Sleep came hard. I sat with Isolde, who was cleaning my mail while I sharpened both swords.
"You will win tomorrow,"
Isolde said in a small voice. "Will you dream that?" She shook her head.
"The dreams don't come since I was baptized."
"So you made it up?"
"I have to believe it," she said.
The stones scraped down the blades. All around me other men were sharpening weapons. "When this is over," I said, "you and I will go away. We shall make a house."
"When this is over,"
she said,
"you will go north. Ever north. Back to your home."
"Well, then you'll come with me."
"Perhaps."
She heaved the mail coat to start on a new patch, scrubbing it with a scrap of fleece to make the link shine.
I can't see my own future. It's all dark.
Well, you shall be the Lady of Bebbanburg, I said, and I shall dress you in furs and crown you with bright silver. She smiled, but I saw there were tears on her face. I took it for fear. And there was plenty of that in the camp that night, especially when men noticed the glow of light showing where the Danes had lit their fires in the nearby hills. We did sleep, but I was woken long before dawn by a small rain. No one slept through it, but all stirred and pulled on war gear. We marched in the grey light. The rain came and went, spiteful and sharp, but always at our backs. Most of us walked, using our few horses to carry shields. Osric and his men went first, for they knew the Shire. Alfred had said that the men of Wiltonshire would be on the right of the battle line, and with them would be the men of Suth Siaxa. Alfred was next, leading his bodyguard that was made of all the men who had come to him in Ethelingaeg, and with him was Harald and the men of Devonshire and Thornseter. Burgweird and the men from Hamptonshire would also fight with Alfred, as would my cousin Ethelred from Mercia, while on the left would be the strong feared of Somerset under Wiglaf. 3,500 men. The women came with us. Some carried their men's weapons, others had their own. No one spoke much. It was cold that morning, and the rain made the grass slippery. Men were hungry and tired. We were all fearful. Alfred had told me to collect 50 or so men to lead, but Leofric was unwilling to lose that many from his ranks, so I took them from Burkweird instead. I took the men who had fought with me in the Hayengel when she had been the Firedraker, and 26 of those men had come from Hampton. Stiapa was with us, for he had taken a perverse liking to me. And I had Father Peerlig, who was dressed as a warrior, not a priest. We were fewer than 30 men, but as we climbed past a green-mounded grave of the old folk, Ethelwald came to us.
"Alfred said I could fight with you," he said.
"He said that?"
"He said I'm not to leave your side."
I smiled at that. If I wanted a man by my side, it would be Edric or Kenwulf, Stiapa or Peerlig, men I could trust to keep their shields firm. "You're not to leave my back," I said to Ethelwald.
"Your back?"
"And in the shield wall you stay close behind me, ready to take my place." He took that as an insult.
"I want to be in the front,"
he insisted. "Have you ever fought in a shield wall?"
"You know I haven't."
"Then you don't want to be in the front," I said. "And besides, if Alfred dies, we'll be king."
"Ah,"
he half smiled.
"So I stay behind you?"
"You stay behind me." Isolt and Hild were leading my horse. "If we lose," I told them, "you both get in the saddle and ride."
"Ride where?"
"Just ride. Take the money," I said. "My silver and treasures, all I possessed, were in the horse's saddlebags. Take it and ride with Hild." Hild smiled at that. She looked pale, and her fair hair was plastered tight to her scalp by the rain. She had no hat, and was dressed in a white shift belted with rope. I was surprised that she'd come with the army, thinking she would have preferred to find a convent, but she had insisted on coming.
"I want to see them dead,"
she told me flatly.
"And the one called Eric, I want to kill myself."
She patted the long, narrow-bladed knife hanging from her belt. "Well, Eric is the one who..." I began, then hesitated.
"The one who whored me," she said.
"So he wasn't the one we killed that night?" She shook her head.
"That was the steersman of Eric's ship. But I'll find Eric, and I won't go back to a convent until I see him screaming in his own blood."
"Full of hate she is," Father Peerlig told me as we followed Hild and Isolt up the hill. "Isn't that bad in a Christian?" Peerlig laughed. "Being alive is bad in a Christian. We see a person as a saint if they're good,
But how few of us become saints? We're all bad. Some of us just try to be good.
I glanced at Hild. She's wasted as a nun, I said.
You do like them thin, don't you?
Peleg said, amused.
Now, I like them meaty, as well-fed heifers. Give me a nice dark Briton with hips like a pair of ale barrels, and I'm a happy priest.
Poor Hild.
Thin as a ray of sunlight she is. But I pity a Dane who crosses her path today.
Osric's scouts came back to Alfred. They'd ridden ahead and seen the Danes. The enemy was waiting, they reported, at the edge of the escarpment, where the hills were highest and where the old people's fort stood. Their banners, the scouts said, were numberless. They'd also seen Danish scouts, so Guthrum and Svein must have known we were coming. On we went, ever higher, climbing into the chalk downs, and the rain stopped, but no sun appeared, for the whole sky was a turmoil of grey and black. The wind gusted from the west. We passed whole rows of graves from the ancient days, and I wondered if they contained warriors who had gone to battle as we did. And I wondered if in the thousands of years to come, other men would toil up these hills with swords and shields. Of warfare there is no end. And I looked into the dark sky for a sign from Thor or Odin, hoping to see a raven fly. But there were no birds, just clouds. And then I saw Osric's men slanting away to the right. We were in a fold of the hills, and they were going around the right-hand hill, and as we reached the saddle between the two low slopes, I saw the level ground, and there, ahead of me, was the enemy. I love the Danes. There are no better men to fight with, drink with, laugh with, or live with. Yet that day, as on so many others of my life, they were the enemy, and they waited for me in a gigantic shield wall arrayed across the down. There were thousands of Danes, spear Danes and sword Danes, Danes who had come to make this land theirs, and we had come to keep it ours.
God give us strength, Father Peleg said when he saw the enemy who had begun shouting as we appeared.
They clashed spears and swords against limewood shields, making a thunder on the hilltop. The ancient fort was the right wing of their army, and men were thick on the green turf walls. Many of those men had black shields, and above them was a black banner, so that was where Guthrum was, while their left wing, which faced our right, was strung out on the open down. And it was there I could see a triangular banner, supported by a small cross-staff, showing a white horse. So, Svein commanded their left, while to the Danish right, our left, the escarpment dropped to the river plains. It was a steep drop, a tumbling hill. We could not hope to outflank the Danes on that side, for no one could fight on such a slope. We had to attack straight ahead, directly into the shield wall, and against the earthen ramparts, and onto the spears and the swords and the war axes of our outnumbering enemy. I looked for Ragnar's eagle-wing banner, and thought I saw it in the fort, but it was hard to be certain, for every crew of Danes flew their standard, and the small flags were crowded together, and the rain had started to fall again, obscuring the symbols. But off to my right, outside the fort, and closer to the bigger standard of the White Horse, was a Saxon flag. It was a green flag with an eagle and a cross, which meant Wulfhere was there, with that part of the Wiltonshire feared which had followed him. There were other Saxon banners in the enemy horde. Not many, maybe a score, and I guess that the Danes had brought men from Mercia to fight for them. All the Saxon banners were in the open ground. None was inside the fort. We were still a long way apart, much farther than a man could shoot an arrow, and none of us could hear what the Danes were shouting. Osric's men were making our right wing, as Wiglaf led his Somerset feared off to the left. We were making a line to oppose their line, but ours would inevitably be shorter. The odds were not quite 2 Danes to 1 Saxon, but it was close.
God help us, Peerig said, touching his crucifix.
Alfred summoned his commanders, gathering them under the rain-sodden banner of the dragon. The Danish thunder went on, the clattering of thousands of weapons against shields, as the king asked his army's leaders for advice. Arnulf of Suthsiaxa, a wiry man with a short beard and a perpetual scowl, advised attack.
"Just attack," he said, waving at the fort. "We'll lose some men on the walls, but we'll lose men anyway."
"We'll lose a lot of men," my cousin Ethelred warned. He only led a small band, but his status as the son of a Mercian ealdorman meant he had to be included in Alfred's council of war.
"We do better defending," Osric growled. "Give a man land to defend and he stands. So let the bastards come to us."
Harald nodded agreement. Alfred cast a courteous eye on Wiglaf of Somerset, who looked surprised to be consulted.
"We shall do our duty, Lord," he said. "Do our duty, whatever you decide."
Leofric and I were present, but the king did not invite our opinion, so we kept silent. Alfred gazed at the enemy, then turned back to us.
"In my experience," he said, "the enemy expects something of us."
He spoke pedantically, in the same tone he used when he was discussing theology with his priests.
"They want us to do certain things. What are those things?"
Wiglaf shrugged, while Arnulf and Osric looked bemused. They had both expected something fiercer from Alfred. Battle, for most of us, was a hammering rage, nothing clever, a killing orgy. But Alfred saw it as a competition of wisdom, or perhaps as a game of tattle that took cleverness to win. That, I'm sure, was how he saw our two armies, as tattle pieces on their checkered board.
"Well?"
he asked.
"They expect us to attack,"
Osric said uncertainly. "They expect us to attack Wulfhere," I said. Alfred rewarded me with a smile.
"Why Wulfhere?"
"Because he's a traitor, and a bastard, and a piece of whore-begotten goat shit," I said.
"Because we do not believe," Alfred corrected me, "that Wulfhere's men will fight with the same passion as the Danes. And we're right, they won't. His men will pull back from killing fellow Saxons."
"But Svein is there," I said.
"Which tells us?"
he asked. The others stared at him. He knew the answer, but he could never resist being a teacher, and so he waited for a response.
"It tells us,"
I supplied it again, "that they want us to attack their left, but they don't want their left to break. That's why Svein is there. He'll hold us, and they'll launch an assault out of the fort to hit the flank of our attack. That breaks the right of our army, and then the whole damn lot come and kill the rest of us." Alfred did not respond, but looked worried, suggesting that he agreed with me. The other men turned and looked at the Danes, as if some magical answer might suggest itself. But none did.
"So do as Lord Arnulf suggests," Harald said. "Attack the fort." "The walls are steep," Wiglaf warned.
The ealdorman of Somerset was a man of sunny disposition, frequent laughter and casual generosity. But now, with his men arrayed opposite the fort's green ramparts, he was downcast.
"Guthrum would dearly like us to assail the fort," the king observed.
This caused some confusion, for it seemed, according to Alfred, that the Danes wanted us to attack their right just as much as they wanted us to attack their left. The Danes, meanwhile, were jeering at us for not attacking at all. One or two ran towards our lines and screamed insults, and their whole shield wall was still banging weapons in a steady, threatening rhythm. The rain made the colours of the shields darker. The colours were black and red and blue and brown and dirty yellow.
"So what do we do?"
Ethelred asked plaintively. There was silence, and I realized that Alfred,
though he understood the problem, had no answer to it. Guthrum wanted us to attack, and probably did not care whether we went against Svein's seasoned warriors on the left of the enemy line, or against the steep, slippery ditches in front of the fort's walls. And Guthrum must also have known that we dared not retreat, because his men would pursue and break us like a horde of wolves savaging a frightened flock. "Attack their left," I said. Alfred nodded, as though he had already come to that conclusion.
"And?"
he invited me.
"Attack it with every man we've got," I said.
There were probably 2,000 men outside the fort, and at least half of those were Saxons. I thought we should assault them in one violent rush, and overwhelm them by numbers. Then the weakness of the Danish position would be revealed, for they were on the very lip of the escarpment, and once they were forced over the edge, they had nowhere to go but down the long, precipitous slope. We could have destroyed those 2,000 men, then reformed our lines for the harder task of attacking the 3,000 inside the fort.
"Employ all our men?" Alfred asked.
"But then Guthrum will attack our flank with every man he has."
"Guthrum won't," I said. "He'll send some men to attack our flank, but he'll keep most of his troops inside the fort. He's cautious. He won't abandon the fort, and he won't risk much to save Svein. They don't like each other." Alfred thought about it, but I could see he did not like the gamble. He feared that while we attacked Svein, the other Danes would charge from the fort and overwhelm our left. I still think he should have taken my advice, but fate is inexorable, and he decided to imitate Guthrum by being cautious.
"We will attack on the right," he said, "and drive off Wulfhere's men. But we must be ready for their counterstroke, and so our left stays where it is."
So, it was decided. Osric and Arnulf, with the men of Wiltonshire and Suthsiaxa, would give battle to Svein and Wulfhere on the open land to the east of the fort. But we suspected that some Danes would come from behind the ramparts to attack Osric's flank, and so Alfred would take his own bodyguard to be a bulwark against that assault. Wiglaf, meanwhile, would stay where he was, which meant a third of our men were doing nothing.
"If we can defeat them," Alfred said, "then their remnant will retreat into the fort and we can besiege it. They have no water there, do they?"
"None," Osric confirmed.
"So they're trapped,"
Alfred said. "And so the whole problem was neatly resolved, and the battle as good as won." He turned to Bishop Aylward.
"A prayer, Bishop, if you would be so kind."
Aylward prayed. The rain fell. The Danes went on jeering. And I knew the awful moment, the clash of the shield walls, was close. I touched Thor's hammer, then Serpent Breath's hilt, for death was stalking us. "God help me," I thought, touching the hammer again. "Thor, help us all." For I did not think we could win.
Chapter 13
The Danes made their battle thunder and we prayed. Aelwold harangued God for a long time, mostly begging him to send angels with flaming swords, and those angels would have been useful, though none appeared. It would be up to us to do the job. We readied for battle. I took my shield and helmet from the horse that Isolt led, but first I teased out a thick hank of her black hair. "Trust me," I said to her, because she was nervous, and I used a small knife to cut the tress. I tied one end of the hair to Serpent Breath's hilt and made a loop with the other end. Isolt watched.
"Why?"
she asked. "I can put the loop over my wrist," I showed her. "Then I can't lose the sword, and your hair will bring me luck." Bishop Aylward was angrily demanding that the women go back. Isolt stood on tiptoe to buckle my wolf-crested helmet in place. Then she pulled my head down and kissed me through the gap in the faceplate.
"I shall pray for you," she said.
"So will I,"
Hill said. "Pray to Odin and Thor," I urged them.
then watched as they led the horse away. The women would hold the horses a quarter mile behind our shield wall, and Alfred insisted they went that far back, so that no man was tempted to make a sudden dash for a horse and gallop away. It was time to make the shield wall, and that is a cumbersome business. Some men offer to be in the front rank, but most try to be behind, and Osric and his battle leaders were shoving and shouting as they tried to settle the men.
"God is with us!"
Alfred was shouting at them. He was still mounted and rode down Osric's slowly forming shield wall to encourage the feared.
"God is with us!"
he shouted again.
"We cannot lose! God is with us!"
The rain fell harder. Priests were walking down the lines offering blessings and adding to the rain by throwing handfuls of holy water at the shields. Osric's feared was mostly five ranks thick, and behind them was a scatter of men with spears. Their job, as the two sides met, was to hurl the spears over their comrades' heads, and the Danes would have similar spear-throwers readying their own weapons.
"God is with us!"
Alfred shouted.
"He is on our side! Heaven watches over us! The holy saints pray for us! The angels guard us! God is with us!"
His voice was already hoarse. Men touched amulets for luck, closed their eyes in silent prayer and tugged at buckles. In the front rank, they obsessively touched their shields against their neighbor's shields. The right-hand edge of every man's shield was supposed to overlap the next shield, so that the Danes were confronted with a solid wall of iron-reinforced limewood. The Danes would make the same wall, but they were still jeering at us, daring us to attack. A young man stumbled from the back of Osric's feared and vomited. Two dogs ran to eat the vomit. A spear-thrower was on his knees, shaking and praying. Father Bjorka stood beside Alfred's standards, with his hands raised in prayer. I was in front of the standards, with Stiapa to my right and Peerling to my left.
"Bring fire on them, O most holy lord!"
Bjorka wailed.
"Bring fire on them and strike them down! Punish them for their iniquities!"
His eyes were tight closed, and his face raised to the rain so that he did not see Alfred gallop back to us and push through our ranks. The king would stay mounted so he could see what happened, and Leofric and a dozen other men were also on horseback, so that their shields could protect Alfred from throwing spears and axes.
"Forward!"
Alfred shouted.
"Forward!"
Leofric repeated the order because the king's voice was so hoarse. No one moved. It was up to Osric and his men to begin the advance, but men are ever reluctant to go against an enemy shield wall. It helps to be drunk. I've been in battles where both sides struggled in a reeking daze of birch wine and ale, but we had little of either, and our courage had to be summoned out of sober hearts, and there was not much to be found on that cold, wet morning.
"Forward!"
Leofric shouted again. And this time Osric and his commanders took up the shout, and the men of Wiltonshire shuffled a few paces forward, and the Danish shields clattered into the wall and locked together, and the sight of that Skjaldborg checked the advance. That's what the Danes call their shield wall, the Skjaldborg, or shield fort. The Danes roared mockery, and two of their younger warriors strutted out of their line to taunt us and invite a duel.
"Stay in the wall!"
Leofric roared.
"Ignore them!"
Osric shouted. Horsemen rode from the fort, perhaps 100 of them, and they trotted behind the Skjaldborg that was formed of Svein's warriors and Wulfhere's Saxons. Svein joined the horsemen. I could see his white horse, the white cloak, and the white horsetail plume. The presence of the horsemen told me that Svein expected our line to break, and he wanted to ride our fugitives down, just as his riders had slaughtered Peredur's broken Britons at Drindinus. The Danes were full of confidence, and so they should have been, for they outnumbered us, and they were all warriors, while our ranks were filled with men more used to the plough than the sword.
Forward!
Osric shouted. His line quivered, but did not advance more than a yard. Rain dripped from the rim of my helmet. It ran down the inside of the faceplate, worked itself inside my mail coat, and ran in shivers down my chest and belly.
"Strike them hard, Lord!"
Biocca shouted.
"Slaughter them without mercy! Break them in pieces!"
Peelig was praying. At least, I think he was praying, for he was speaking in his own tongue. And I heard the word "Dew" repeated over and over, and I knew from Isolt that "Dew" was the Briton's word for God. Ethelwald was behind Peelig. He's supposed to be behind me, but Edric had insisted on being at my back, so Ethelwald would protect Peelig instead. He was chattering incessantly, trying to cover his nervousness, and I turned on him. "Keep your shield up," I told him.
"I know, I know."
"You protect Peelig's head, understand?"
"I know."
He was irritated that I had given him advice.
"I know,"
he repeated petulantly.
"Forward! Forward!"
Osric called. Like Alfred, he was on horseback, and he went up and down behind his line, sword drawn, and I thought he would jab the blade at his men to goad them onwards. They went a few paces, and the Danish shields came up again, and the linewood made a knocking sound, as the Skjaldborg was made, and once again our line faltered. Svein and his horsemen were now at the very far flank, but Osric had placed a group of picked warriors there, ready to guard the open end of his line.
"For God! For Wiltonshire!"
Osric shouted.
"Forward!"
Alfred's men were on the left of Osric's field, where we were bent slightly back, ready to receive the expected flank attack from the fort. We went forward readily enough, but then we were mostly warriors, and knew we could not advance in front of Osric's more nervous troops. I almost stepped into a scrap of the ground where, astonishingly, three leverets lay low and quivering. I stared at them, and hoped that the men behind me would avoid the little beasts, and knew they would not. I do not know why hares leave their young in the open, but they do, and there they lay, three sleek leverets in a hollow of the downs, doubtless the first things to die in that day of wind and rain.
"Shout at them!"
Osric called.
"Tell them they're bastards! Call them sons of whores! Say they're shit from the north! Shout at them!"
He knew that was one way to get men moving. The Danes were screaming at us, calling us women, saying we had no courage, and no one in our ranks was shouting back. But Osric's men started now, and the wet sky was filled with the noise of weapons banging on shields and men calling insults. I had hung serpent breath on my back. In the crush of battle, a sword is easier to draw over the shoulder than from the hip, and the first stroke can then be a vicious downward hack. I carried Waspsting in my right hand. Waspsting was a sax, a short sword, a stout blade for stabbing, and in the press of men heaving against an enemy shield wall, a short sword can do more damage than a long blade. My shield, iron-rimmed, was held on my left forearm by two leather loops. The shield had a metal boss the size of a man's head, a weapon in itself. Stiapa, to my right, had a long sword, not as long as the one with which he had fought me at Sippenham, but still a hefty blade, though in his big hand it looked almost puny. Peelig carried a boar spear, short and stout and with a wide blade. He was saying the same phrase over and over. "Hien tad hwin hwythin I nirfedd, sanctidie die nyw." I learned later it was the prayer Jesus had taught his disciples. Stiapa was muttering that the Danes were bastards. "Bastards," he said. Then, "God help me, bastards." He kept saying it over and over. "Bastards, God help me, bastards." My mouth was suddenly too dry to speak, and my stomach felt sour and my bowels loose.
"Forward! Forward!"
Osric called, and we shuffled on, shields touching. And we could see the enemy's faces now. We could see men's unkempt beards and yellow-toothed snarls, see their scarred cheeks, pox skin and broken noses. My faceplate meant I could only see directly ahead. Sometimes it's better to fight without a faceplate, to see the attacks coming from the side. But in the clash of shield walls, a faceplate is useful. The helmet was lined with leather,